It is Friday, November 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabwe's new president promises reform. More than 200 people are killed in a mosque attack in the northern Sinai Peninsula, and Miami, Florida responds to the threat of rising seas. It's all ahead. Emmerson Mnangagwa became Zimbabwe's first new president in decades on Friday before a capacity crowd at the National Sports Stadium in Harare. Mnangagwa, who was fired November 5th from his position as Zimbabwe's vice president, was sworn in as president, ending 37 years of authoritarian rule by Robert Mugabe.
I will protect and promote the rights of the people of Zimbabwe.
Among the many tests he faced will be rebuilding the country's economy, which was left shattered by nearly four decades of Mugabe's rule. Former President Mugabe and his wife Grace have been granted immunity from prosecution. The military took over state institutions after Mugabe suggested he would appoint his 52-year-old wife as vice president. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell is in Harare. She describes to me Friday's inaugural ceremony.
It was an extraordinary day today in Harare. The stadium seats about 60,000 people, and it was packed to the rafters. People were hanging off seats. People were just crowded into boxes. They were on the field. It was very well attended. It was exuberant. There was singing, there was dancing, and there was a great sense of relief, I would say.
What did the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, say?
He spoke at length, and he made a lot of promises. He made a lot of promises about sweeping reforms in Zimbabwe. He acknowledged that Zimbabwe has had many troubles, and most of his speech focused on the need to improve the economy. For example, he assured Zimbabweans that he would make it easier for them to get their hands on hard currency. He assured them that he would try to loosen import and export restrictions. And he also talked about the need to honor international debts that Zimbabwe had, but noted that that might be difficult as Zimbabwe embarks on this exciting but challenging chapter.
Yes, well, apparently, speaking of that, the International Monetary Fund has said that Zimbabwe needs immediate economic reforms.
Right, and so that's why his statement about wanting to honor the debt was timely. Zimbabwe obviously needs sweeping economic change. Mnangagwa is in a position now where he has to try very hard to attract much-needed foreign investment. To that end, he also promised international investors, and I quote, "Your money is safe here in Zimbabwe." So he's going to be trying to get as much income as he can to honor those debts and to also reform the economy. But I think he acknowledged it's going to be an uphill battle.
What about future elections? Is there any indication when those could take place?
Mnangagwa was very clear on this point. He said elections are going to happen on time. By that, he means that according to the Zimbabwean constitution, they're supposed to happen sometime from mid-July to mid-August. The date will be decided a little closer to the date. But he assured Zimbabweans that they would happen on time. And he also said, quite touchingly, the voice of the people is the voice of God. So he expressed great confidence in the electoral process.
Well, former President Robert Mugabe apparently did not attend the ceremony. However, he and his wife have reached some sort of agreement with the Zimbabwean government about immunity. What is known about that?
Not much at this stage, but what I can tell you is that everybody in Zimbabwe in the leadership right now is urging Zimbabweans to remember the difficult times they had, but to turn a new leaf, to forgive. And not to forget, maybe, but to forgive. So there's a clear, concerted political effort to help Mr. Mugabe transition with dignity and to give him room, if he chooses to stay in Zimbabwe, to do so with dignity and with comfort. So right now we don't know much about that plan, but we do know that the political establishment is
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to say?
The mood here in Harare is is really something to behold. At the stadium, I talked to numerous people who are in their early 30s or younger who said, you know, we still can't really believe this is happening because they didn't believe what they're hearing in the news, I suppose. And it was really, I think for a lot of people watching today, it was strange and it was largely welcomed. It's clear that the political situation in Zimbabwe is still a little bit fractious. What was notable was when the commissioner of police went to perform his salutation of the new president, he was widely booed by the crowd, whereas the army commander was cheered. The army and the police have long been at odds in Zimbabwe, and the police have been accused of supporting the ruling ZANU-PF. And so it's clear that there's still quite a little bit of friction in the security services, and I think it's worth watching that because I think a lot of Zimbabweans are worried that could lead to trouble in the future. And so we're all eagerly, maybe with a bit of anxiety, watching that situation.
VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Harare, Zimbabwe. Well, joining me by phone is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, as we talked about yesterday on the phone, this is one of the series of days in the U.S. Surrounding the Thanksgiving holiday. Of course, Wednesday you have to travel. Yesterday was Thanksgiving, and today is Black Friday, the day when everyone runs out to shopping malls and begins their holiday shopping. But in the broader sense, the big trending story today is this attack in Egypt that has left more than 230 people dead at a mosque in Egypt that was attacked by an ISIS-affiliated group. And the fact that these two things are trending simultaneously, this attack and Black Friday shopping here in the U.S., is giving a lot of people pause and a lot to talk about on social media. There are some people saying that it's very bizarre and jarring to see so many people celebrating and being thankful and going out and shopping amidst all these scenes of terror and horror in Egypt. And then you have a lot of people talking on social media about the coverage. They're saying that because this attack took place not in the West, but in Africa, Northern Africa, that it's not getting as much attention as it would if it was, say, in Europe or the United States. And so that's giving a lot of people something to talk about. They're saying it's the coverage does not weigh with the severity and the gravity of this attack. They're saying that there's some bias in terms of the coverage that you see when attacks happen in Africa or the Middle East, that they don't get covered as much. So you have a lot of people talk about that. And you have a lot of people just hoping that whatever happens with this attack, hopefully there are some survivors to recover. Hopefully the community there will rebuild. But a lot of people just sending up their thoughts and prayers for the more than 230 people that were killed there today, and hoping that attacks like these don't become the norm. We've seen more and more of them happen. People are saying that this can't become the new reality, that these attacks happen with greater and greater frequency. Something needs to be done to stop them.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. We will be having more on that story coming up later in the program. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. asked Pakistan to arrest a freed cleric and should charge him with terrorism. Nepal hopes upcoming elections will bring political stability. A Texas company reports selling lethal weapons to Ukraine. And London's Oxford Circus station is closed and a customer incident is being investigated. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the French National Center for Scientific Research have determined that ultra-high energy cosmic rays that bombard the Earth do not originate from our own galaxy, but from others tens or even hundreds of millions of light years away. Cosmic rays are described as high-energy radiation that consists of high-speed protons and nuclei. Ultra-high energy cosmic ray particles are said to have kinetic energy that can be more than 1 quintillion electron volts. That's a 1 followed by 18 zeros. The researchers made their findings after studying data gathered since 2004 by the Pierre Auger Observatory in Argentina. While cosmic radiation can be quite hazardous to humans in space, thanks to the magnetic field and atmosphere, those of us on Earth are pretty much protected from most cosmic rays. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a controversial electronics manufacturer is scheduled to be constructed in Wisconsin. Egyptian media are reporting that at least 235 worshippers were killed after Islamic militants sprayed them with gunfire during Friday prayers in the town of Bir al-Abed outside the northern Sinai provincial capital of Al-Arish. It was the first major attack on a mosque in Egypt in many years, although militants have targeted at least three churches in bloody terror incidents in the past 12 months. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Frightened residents fled the center of the town of Bir al-Abed after Islamic militants fired on people both inside and outside the Rauda Mosque. Scores of bodies were strewn across the mosque's carpeted floor. A man claiming to have been inside the mosque during the attack told Arab media that militants in four-wheel drive vehicles opened fire inside the house of worship following an explosion. Eyewitnesses also say the militants fired on ambulances as emergency personnel tried to evacuate the wounded to hospitals in nearby Arish. Egyptian media reported that several government targets were also attacked inside the town. Egyptian culture minister Helmi Namnam said on Egyptian TV that the attack was part of an ongoing war that the Muslim Brotherhood group and its allies are waging against Egypt. Several other former government officials made similar claims. The Muslim Brotherhood denied responsibility following previous terror attacks. Egypt's Islamic Endowments Minister told government media the militants are resorting to extremely brutal attacks because they are becoming desperate. He says that attacking mosques is the last card they have to play. They have attacked churches before, claiming the victims were infidels, but now they are attacking mosques because their previous attacks failed. He says they are proving that it is they who in fact are enemies of God. Arab media have reported a recent influx of Islamic militants from Iraq and Syria to parts of North Africa, including Egypt and Libya. Egyptian media have accused Qatar and Turkey of helping terrorists to flee Iraq and Syria to North Africa. Qatar and Turkey deny the accusations. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qasim recently told VOA that part of the problem is that Egyptian security forces need better training to deal with acts of terrorism.
For years, there was talk that it was necessary to recalibrate the police force and at least part of the military to become counter-terrorism forces. And unfortunately, we know of very little programs that have actually taken place to make a serious shift.
Egyptian media reported that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi met with top security officials, including the defense and interior ministers, immediately after the attack, as security was stepped up around government buildings and key infrastructure. Egyptian government warplanes reportedly attacked terrorist targets in the Sinai following the carnage at the mosque. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The $10 billion deal to bring a Taiwanese-based electronics manufacturer to Wisconsin is raising questions from critics, despite the promise that the investment could provide tens of thousands of new American jobs and other long-term benefits. The deal's critics say Wisconsin taxpayers could lose money in what is the largest U.S. state tax incentive package ever offered to a foreign company. VOA's Kane Faraba has more from Racine, Wisconsin.
When Gonzalo Perez bought the Castlewood Restaurant in Sturtevant, Wisconsin last December, It was one of the few outposts among these corn and soybean fields where farmers could go out to eat. It could become much more than that for Perez.
It's my lottery ticket.
That's because one of the largest economic development projects in the United States is moving in right next door. Taiwanese company Foxconn plans to build a massive flat-screen manufacturing and technology facility in Mount Pleasant, employing thousands of workers when completed. The site is only a few kilometers away from Perez's restaurant, and he hopes it does not take too long to start cashing in.
I hope I get a lot of business from construction people in the beginning.
As they build this facility, they're going to require 10,000 construction employees plus another 6,000 indirect employees. When this ecosystem is up and running in the state of Wisconsin, it will be 13,000 additional employees to the state and another upwards of 20,000 indirect or induced jobs.
Mark Hogan heads the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which helped attract Foxconn to the state.
We passed special legislation, which really created a pathway for the company to be successful in the state. And that had to do with environmental regulations. It had to do with incentives.
The package offered to Foxconn includes approximately $3 billion in tax incentives if the Taiwanese company invests $10 billion in its facility. Those incentives have drawn fire.
This is the largest in U.S. history. And it was somewhat surprising because the state of Wisconsin generally does not play this game.
Economics professor Stephen Deller says one of his primary concerns as a taxpayer is the potential for the state to actually owe money to Foxconn.
But there is the Wisconsin Agricultural and Manufacturing Tax Credit. The way that the taxpayers may be on the hook for paying some money is that if Foxconn is not paying any taxes and they have a tax credit, that means that the state is now paying Foxconn.
But for Gonzalo Perez, who came to the United States from Mexico 30 years ago, his biggest concern is not the tax incentives. He's looking at the potential increase in the number of his customers.
How many customers a day would you say you get right now?
Probably 200.
And after it's built, how many do you think you'll get?
Well, I hope I triple that.
He may not have to wait long to see an uptick in business. Groundbreaking on the new facility is planned for next year, and as many as 1,000 Foxconn employees could be working in the state later in 2018. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Racine, Wisconsin.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Preparing for a century of steadily higher tides is a central challenge for city officials from Boston to Bangkok. The U.S. city of Miami, Florida, and its neighbors are home to nearly 3 million people and billions of dollars of real estate development. VOA Steve Barragona has a look at what rising seas mean for one of the most vulnerable cities in the United States.
Cruise ships sail from the port of Miami past a city that loves its waterfront. But as the seas rise with climate change, the water won't stay put.
So this is your stormwater drain, which is water is coming up through.
Sue Brogan lives in Miami's Shorecrest neighborhood, on a street that's barely above sea level. In the highest tides, the ocean backs up through the storm drains into low-lying neighborhoods like hers. For now, it's a nuisance. But Brogan knows it's only going to get worse.
It's more of a warning situation. Where is it going to go from this? And if we don't address these problems locally and globally, we're going to have problems, big problems.
Big parts of South Florida are at risk of going underwater in the coming decades. Across Biscayne Bay, the city of Miami Beach is adapting, raising streets, installing pumps, and more. It's expensive. Residents are paying for $500 million worth of upgrades, says Public Works Director Eric Carpenter.
Thankfully, our residents, the folks that are, you know, footing the bill for this work, realize that the cost of doing nothing is much greater.
City of Miami residents have also come to that realization. Voters just approved a $200 million bond measure for upgrades in Shorecrest and elsewhere. And the city is talking with residents about more controversial solutions, like redesigning entire neighborhoods, buying up some of the most flood-prone homes, and turning the land into flood-absorbing parks. Miami's Chief Resilience Officer, Jane Gilbert, says that won't happen soon.
It's really much more long-term, and we feel the more we are having those conversations now, the easier it is for everybody to adapt over time.
Over time, radical measures may be necessary. Miami's fate depends largely on how much and how fast the oceans swell. But the pace is increasing.
Mention it, that's not a bad idea.
Caroline Lewis heads the climate advocacy group, the Clio Institute. She says retreat from the shore is inevitable.
We're going to have to leave sooner or later. But if we can have a planned retreat, and we could implement some of our ideas for keeping people as safe as possible for as long as possible, then we would have accomplished a great deal that the whole world can learn from.
But in a city that carved itself out of a swampy wilderness, optimists abound.
There's an engineering solution to every problem. It just comes down to, is there the political will to go through whatever pain may be associated with that solution and the will to try and fund it?
Questions South Florida and the world's coastal cities will be asking for decades to come. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Miami.
And that is our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. continues to prosecute endangered species traffickers. Michael Hegarty, an Irish national, was sentenced in federal court in Miami, Florida, on November 14th to 18 months in prison, to be followed by 3 years of supervised release for fraudulently facilitating the transportation and concealment of a libation cup carved from the horn of an endangered rhinoceros. Hegarty's sentencing is the result of the strong partnership between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Justice Department to investigate and prosecute those who engage in illegal trade in protected wildlife, said Jeffrey Wood, Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice. There is a frequent connection between wildlife smuggling and organized criminal activity. We remain committed to combating this illegality. In July 2017, Belgium extradited Hegarty to the United States. Hegarty's arrest and subsequent extradition were part of Operation Crash, a U.S. crackdown on criminal trafficking in rhinoceros horns. Hegarty's 18-month sentence was the high end of the sentencing range for his crime. Operation Crash was conducted by the Department of the Interior's Fish and Wildlife Service in coordination with other federal and local law enforcement agencies, including U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Homeland Security Investigations. Office of International Affairs of the Department of Justice played an important role in the extradition procedures. A crash is the term for a herd of rhinoceroses. Operation Crash was an effort to detect, deter, and prosecute those engaged in the illegal killing of rhinoceros and the unlawful trafficking of rhinoceros horns. The sentencing of Michael Hegarty sends a message to those who profit from the slaughter and illicit trade of wildlife. You will be caught and prosecuted no matter where you hide, said Ed Grace, acting chief of law enforcement for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I commend your special agents who connected this defendant to the Rathkeel Rovers, a transnational organized crime syndicate responsible for trafficking endangered rhinoceros products worldwide. Thank you to our international counterparts and to the U.S. Department of Justice for arresting, extraditing, and prosecuting this individual.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.